Very happy to be here. Thanks for joining. It's good to see so many familiar faces here. So today I'll be talking about some work I've done in collaboration with a Princeton graduate student, Kristina Kleisch, which actually has done a lot of the work I'm going to present here today, and also some collaboration with Lloyd Knox at UC Davis, Lachlan Lancaster, and Olivier Duray. So we all know we live in this, or supposedly we live in this era of precision cosmology, where we know, we're supposed to know, all the constituents that form our universe at the very beginning that we can probe with cosmic microwave background, all the way to all the richness we observe today with the billions of galaxies we observe in optical astronomy. And I guess the question I'm posing today is whether this picture that we have of precision cosmology is actually really precise, or whether there's something we're actually missing in this picture. And the point I want to put the hammer on today is what we think we know about the expansion history of our universe, at fairly late time, below redshift 3 or so, all the way to today, redshift 0. So this is summarized in this blog by the Planck collaboration. This black line is what you think the CMB is telling you about the expansion history of the universe at late time. It's some extrapolation from measurement made all the way to z of 1,000 or so. And some of these other measurements come from BAO, Baryonic Acoustic Oscillation, and of course the distance ladder measurement coming from Cepheid and supernova. As you can see, this is the well-known level of tension. At this point, it's quite a bit higher than what you think the other probes are telling you. But what I want to emphasize in this plot is that not all probes of HSD, the orbital expansion rates, are born equal. In fact, on this plot, in this parameter space, only really this point is the recent old measurement based on distance ladder. We're using Cepheid to calibrate supernova luminosity distance is actually a measurement, a direct measurement of the orbital expansion rate today. And all the other measurement or data points shown here are actually extrapolation or require other ingredients to be brought into the measurement in order to extract a Hubble rate out of these data. And that's especially true of BIO and, of course, of the CMB. And primarily in case of the BIO and the CMB, the quantity that you need to know in order to measure the Hubble rate today is the sound horizon. So this is the sound horizon, which corresponds to how far the sound wave propagated in the baryon photon plasma at a very early time before the epoch of recombination, which is, of course, just a simple integral over the sound speed of the baryon photon plasma, which, just very simple, all the way to the epoch of decoupling. So the thing is, if you think about cosmology, these kind of expressions are so simple that we would think that in 2019 we actually understand all the physics that goes on into this kind of integral. But lately, maybe it's something we actually don't understand out of these kind of measurements.
Just a comment. It's a bit funny you say that it's a direct measurement because, of course, it assumes that surfaces are standard candles and it's assumed the supernova, so it's not really a direct measurement.
Well, it's a direct measurement in the sense that what you're actually measuring is the Hubble rate. Here, you're measuring an angle in the sky. The CMB, right. You're measuring an angle in the sky.
And then you have to make some assumption, and I guess in one is that supernova and Cepheids are simple as spherical cows, and then here sound waves are simple as spherical cows. So that's the
point is that the goal of these measurements is directly, when you look at the luminosity distance, you get what you're really measuring is H of Z, and the H naught is really the normalization of this line. So the goal of that distance ladder, the normalization of this line, is the Hubble constant. So if you believe this luminosity distance, then the direct measurement is the Hubble rate. So I told you that the sound horizon is the key measurement that you need to enter in order to convert, say, CMB or BAO to HSD measurement. As I just said, you measure angles in the sky when you measure the CMB. And if you know something, if you assume something about late-time cosmology, like dark energy and dark matter, you can convert these kind of angles in the sky to a measurement of the sound horizon. So you could use a CMB start to extract the sound horizon, assuming a late-time cosmology, and you can use the sound horizon to try to calibrate the next step, which is the baryon acoustical oscillation, which is a very similar kind of angle on the sky signal, but now projected into much lower redshift, because now these kind of signature from the sound wave gets imprinted in the distribution of galaxies at lower redshift. But in this case, because you've opened this third dimension of the redshift direction, now you get actually two measurements. You get, of course, this angle, this ratio of the sound horizon to this distance to where you're measuring your galaxies. We also get the line of sight BAO, which tells you something slightly different, which is product of H and Z times the sound horizon. So now, if you know the sound horizon from the CMB, say, then you can use this measurement of the sun horizon to try to extract what the expansion history is out of these DA and HZ. And conversely, say if you have a measurement of H naught of the orbital rate at today, say from standard candles, you can kind of revert this relation and use BAO to try to infer a value of the sun horizon. So either way, either you have an input, you get an output, just depending which way you want to go. But I would argue that this plot here that I didn't make, and this is from the Planck collaboration, is a little misleading. Because if you actually read the caption from this plot, it will say that the residual measurement is high, and all of the other measurements for this plot are compatible with CMB measurement. But what they don't tell you, what they tell you, but it's not necessarily super clear, is that all of these data points here actually move up and down as you change the sound horizon. So these points are not actually fixed on this plot, but it depends on what you assume about the sound horizon.
Which points?
All of the BAO points. These three.
I see.
Yeah. So these points can move up and down as you change the sound horizon. And of course here, to make this point, this plot, they've actually calibrated all of these data points to the black line, just assuming the sound horizon measured from the CMB. So it's not too surprising, I must say, that they argue that they agree, but then you kind of feed in with the new measurement the CMB itself. So I said this is a bit misleading. Now I say I want to kind of invert this problem, and I will ask the question, what if I take this data point, this BAO data point, but instead I calibrate them, so instead of calibrating them from the CMB, I'm going to calibrate them from, say, the residual distance ladder using SIFID and supernovae. So you can do that. And in fact, if you do that, you can get a very good agreement. So if I go back here, you see there's a lot of distance between these points compared to, say, some lambda CDM prediction here. This is just plotting H of Z. The other one was H of Z over 1 plus Z. So it's slightly different. But you can see that you can actually align everything quite nicely. But the only thing you have to do in order to align, say, residual measurement of the Hubble constant and the BAO is to assume a different value of the sound horizon. In this case, a value that's about maybe 8% smaller than what, if you just open your Planck paper and you read the value of, say, 147 comoving megaparsec. So if you're willing to make any of this kind of trade-off in the value of the sun horizon, you can actually try to reconcile what you think the BAOs are doing with what the local H naught measurements are doing. So that's a good thing to know. In fact, this has been done in this paper, Eller et al., very recently. And so one way to think about this whole Hubble tension or this discrepancy about the expansion of the universe at late time is to think that it's really a discrepancy about what we think the sound horizon value actually is. So if you use some of these late time probes like CIFID and Supernova, and then you use that to calibrate the sound horizon BAO. You use these kind of data to get H naught, and then you feed into the BAO, you get a measurement of the sun horizon, which is low. On the other hand, if you use CMB to extract the sun horizon, assuming dark energy plus dark matter, and then the CDM, you get a higher value of the sun horizon. So one way to think about this kind of early time versus late time discrepancy in the Hubble constant is just saying that actually, these two kind of measurements are telling different things about the size of the baryon photon sun horizon. So if that's the problem, so let's look again at this baryon photon sun horizon and see if there's like physics we can introduce to try to change it. So again, as I said before, this is a very simple integral. So there's not that many things you can do about it. The first thing you can do is like, okay, I got the sound speed here. Maybe I could try to modify the sound speed. In order to do that, you basically coupled extra things to photons and baryons. I will say this is like hard thing to do without messing up the rest of the CMB. And I'm not saying this is impossible to do, but I think it's a hard thing to do. So today I'm not going to talk about that. So if you couple other things to the baryon or the photons, you're going to change this ratio of basically the baryon loading of the plasma. And you could imagine that will change the numerical value of the sound speed. This is a hard thing to do. I'm not going to talk about this today. The other thing you can do to change this integral is to change what the Hubble rate is doing at early times. Especially if you imagine that you can increase somehow the Hubble rate at early times, you can actually suppress this integrand, and so the sound horizon comes out a bit smaller and might help reconcile BIO and CFID measurement of the Hubble constant. But if you want to change the sound, you can change the Hubble rate at early times. But there's a lot of things. The Hubble rate feeds in pretty much every single quantity in cosmology, all the evolution of the cosmological perturbation, all of that. So there's a lot of things that depends on what the Hubble rate is doing at early times. So at first it might seem that it's a very hard thing to do without messing up a lot of different things. So it's important to consider when does this sound horizon integral gets most of its contribution. So it's an integral over, 1 over the Hubble rate. And it's a bit hard to see, but there are actually two curves here. So this contribution here is kind of beige peak that just peaks about the recombination epoch here. So this is actually the damping scale, the CMB damping scale. And the sound horizon is this kind of very shallow blue contribution here. So what this tells you, this is DRX of D log H. It tells you what's the relative contribution at each value of the scale factor to this integral. And basically the sound horizon gets this kind of fairly broad kernel in terms of its contribution. So you get contribution for multiple redshift prior to recombination. Well, if you're talking about the silk damping of the photon, the thing that erases the CMB on very small scale because photon can diffuse out of very small upper densities, it gets a contribution much closer to the Debye recombination. So if you would like to change the sound horizon without doing too much damage to the CMB, you have to do it in this kind of window here, where you have a sizable contribution to change this integral, but why not doing it too late so that you start changing all the damping physics and the damping tail of the CMB that's pretty well measured by now. So this is a kind of the fiducial epoch, so around, say, redshift 10 to the 4 or so, that you will like to introduce some new physics to change the sound horizon without doing too much damage on the CMB. So if you're a particle physicist and you say you want to add extra components at early times, we have a lot of models out there that has extra types of relativistic species in them. Things like enantiomerism twigs, et cetera. And in all of these kind of extension, having extra relativistic species kind of a general prediction. So that's the kind of first thing you're going to turn your attention to. And the problem with that this doesn't work, is that if you just start adding extra relativistic species at early time, which would increase the Hubble rate. So you add extra energy density, you increase the Hubble rate. Sounds like you're going to change the sound horizon like we want. But the problem is that actually leads to too much damping. So this is actually two different amounts of CMB with n effective equals 1 and n effective equals 10. It's a bit hard to see, but actually all the hot spot and cold spot here are much more damped. So the cold spot are less cold and the hot spot are less hot. And that's pretty easy to measure in the CMB. If n effective is too large, if too much radiation every time, it just doesn't work.
Is this because of the free streaming or not?
This is mostly because you've changed because ineffective, actually this is shown here in these kind of dashed line. Ineffective is a pretty flat contribution to the energy density, and so it tends to affect both the sun horizon and the damping scale at more or less the same rate. And that's a problem. So you introduce way too much damping in your CMB. And you know, if you're familiar with this kind of cosmological analysis that that fits, you know, to the Planck data and other data, you know that you're actually varying a lot of parameters at the same time in these kind of cosmological analyses. And you can ask, well, can I just try to undo some of this damage that I've introduced, this extra damping, for instance, that I've introduced by increasing the amount of radiation early times by just, say, changing the helium fraction? And you'll be right. I mean, you can try to play this game and add more parameters to your model, like something like helium, for instance. And it's true. And in this paper, it's actually been done. You can try to erase most of the damage done by ineffective. But if you look carefully, once you try to kind of maximize or minimize the amount of damage you do, there's some signature that actually remains, and this signature is actually a phase shift of the CMB, the angular CMB power spectrum peaks. That comes from the free streaming in the neutrinos. This is where the free streaming in the neutrinos comes from. This is where, you know, we can try to measure it. And this phase shift is a very robust signature of having extra relativistic species at early times. In order to understand where this extra shift comes from in the CMB peaks, we have to really examine the behavior of cosmological fluctuation in the presence of this extra radiation. So just like, you know, like the kind of intro 101 to free streaming radiation in the CMB here. So if you have this kind of free streaming radiation at early times, because they're not scattering with each other, their perturbation cannot really stay coherent on a long time scale. So basically, if you start with a neutrino, free streaming neutrino perturbation at some time, it's like a Gaussian fluctuation or something, and you just press play and let it evolve according to its equation of motion, it would just spread because it's just streaming out. It will not emit very coherent sound wave like the photon barons, for instance, because the photon keeps scattering off electrons. And this is what is actually shown here. So these are actually like densities, over densities in both photons and neutrinos, a function of physical distance. This is not Fourier space, this is actually real space. And so the photon have very coherent sound wave propagating. So here, basically, what I've done, I've put some Gaussian initial density, press play, and just froze the movie at some very specific time. And this is basically the BIO. This is the sound wave in the baryon photon plasma, where, you know, if you Fourier transform it, you get all the acoustic peak in the CMB. On the other hand, because the neutrinos are not scattering, they can actually, as I said, they just kind of stream out, and it actually gets ahead. And that's really the point. They get ahead of the photon baryon sound horizon. And because this actually thing can get ahead of it, it exerts some kind of gravitational tug, this little gravitational pull on the sound wave front. And that tends to suppress a little bit the amplitude of the photon fluctuation and actually shift them a little bit. So it's really just a pure gravitational effect. That just, you know, because the two things are coupled by the gravitational potential. And that gives rise to this slight amplitude suppression and the slight phase shift of the photon sound waves. And we can actually measure that in the CMB spectrum. And what's interesting about the magnitude of this, the shift, is that it's basically proportional to the amount of free streaming radiation you have in the universe. So the more free streaming radiation you have in the universe, the more this phase shift is large. And that's why, as you increase ineffective, you tend to increase this amount of phase shift. You can shift the whole spectrum toward larger scales, so lower L, as you increase say ineffective. Okay, so that's where this kind of damage comes from, as you increase ineffective. And you know, at face value, you can try to know because of what I just told you, you know it's not going to work. But you know, people have tried to do that. So what if I just generalize my Landau CDM model, just add an effective, and see what kind of measurement of the sun horizon I get? It doesn't really change anything. And the reason it doesn't change anything is exactly the reason I just mentioned to you. This phase shift, it really just pins you down, and you don't have any freedom to really get an effective large enough to sizably change the sun horizon. So that's too bad, because as I said, you know, extra radiation is probably the first kind of theoretical ideas you will have as a particle physicist to try to change of sun arise in early times.
So you could have this extra radiation self-contracting a lot, so it doesn't have to free a stream.
Yeah, that's the point of the talk. Right?
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, all right, so just wrapping up this first section. So one way to think about the subtle tension is really just think about the sun horizon is off, and the sun horizon is really set at early times. So this is telling you, if you believe this is telling you that there's something going on at early times, before redshift of 1,000. And if you want to change the sun horizon, you have to do it, as I said, just 2 decades before recombination. But at first glance, just ineffective, or just adding radiation doesn't work because of all the reasons I just mentioned. And what I'm asking here, is there any way to rescue ineffective? And you know, one of the motivations to try to do that is that neutrino physics, so if you just, you know, forget about cosmology, you just look, okay, what is the status of neutrino physics? If I just, you know, ask my neutrino physicist what's going on in neutrino physics right now, it's quite interesting, to say the least. And because I'm not a neutrino physicist, I'm going to be quoting from someone else, but so I just extract this from Michele Maltoni's talk from last year. And there's interesting discrepancies there that has to do with the rate of oscillation of electron-to-electron neutrinos and muon-to-muon neutrinos. That seems to point something that's well beyond just the three neutrino model. And you know, if you will take this at face value, this will be like a large number of sigma evidence for some physics beyond the standard model, if you take it at face value. And the reason why people maybe don't take it at face value is because this other channel, so the this muon channel that doesn't show any anomalies, and that's just really hard to try to reconcile these two statements here, with these anomalies with some channels that are not anomalous. So the statement that he makes is that if these anomalies are confirmed and this bound from the muon neutrinos are not changed, then new physics will be needed in the neutrino sector. And it might involve some new neutrinos, throughout neutrinos, et cetera, but it might also involve something else, like some unusual neutrino properties. And I'm gonna just take this and run with it, basically. And I'm gonna try to save an effective by just getting inspired by the situation in neutrino physics. And what I'm going to do here, at least for the first part, for the first 45 minutes of this talk or so, is I'm just going to say, okay, what if there's just new physics in the neutrino sector? And the first thing you can do is assume that neutrino are not free streaming but can scatter of themselves. This is a bit of a spherical cow, at least for now. We'll make some more precision a bit later, but just assume that that you now allow neutrinos to scatter of themselves. They don't scatter off, you know, electrons, I mean, except through the weak interaction. They're only going to scatter on themselves. And you know, this is not a new thing, right? I mean, there's a whole slew of work on these kind of non-free streaming radiation or non-free streaming neutrinos, and you can find some work done on this, including by myself and my collaborators. But the basic of these kind of ideas is, let's just say we assume some kind of very simple Yukawa-like interaction as given by this, where you have some kind of massive mediator, going to be, say, MeV scale, if you want the right scaling here, that couples to some neutrino with some flavor structure. Yes, I'll come back to that later. So this is going to be a very low energy theory, and I'm gonna have to UV complete it into the electroweak. Yes, and it's a hard thing to do, but I'll do. If I have time, I'll mention.
Why don't you mention very quickly now? How do you make sure that electrons don't couple to this?
So I mean, you can. I guess if you want both the neutrino mass, the neutrino mass and these kind of interaction, you probably have some kind of double seesaw you have to do.
What do you mean double?
In the sense that. I'll discuss this, but if you want to symmetrically explain the smallest neutrino mass and these interaction, which is going to need to be very strong in order to fit the CMB as I want it to be, You cannot at the same mechanism give you both the self-interaction and the neutrino and the neutrino mass, because you'll see that this kind of four fermion coupling constant gets proportional to neutrino mass in these kind of just simple CISO scenario.
So these are the left-handed neutrinos?
The Majorana are left-handed, yeah. But I don't want to get too tangled into particle physics, because I really want to tell you about the cosmology of these things.
Yeah, but the model really matters.
Yeah, but see, so my philosophy on this was to say, okay, if I can find a cosmology that actually works in this simple model, then I'm going to motivate particle physicists to think a bit harder about this problem. I mean, this is exactly what happens. We put this paper out, and people got interested in this and came out with a model for this. And now that's why I can tell you more about the model, because now actually people have worked on that.
Oh, okay.
So that's.
There is a model, though.
There is a model. Yes.
Okay. So you talk about
afterwards, because I'm very curious.
Yeah.
I'll do my best to speed up and get to it. Okay.
No, you don't have to speed up. We'll go through everything.
That's okay. So first.
There is a model where there is no strongly coupled electrons.
Oh yeah, that you can do. I mean, I can at least think about two different models. I can tell you that.
Okay. But you don't have to speed up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So for now, just thinking about cosmology. So these kind of interaction, which actually been studied in different papers, especially this one is pretty interesting because it was mostly inspired by what we did here. Some Yukawa, but you know, at the energy scale you're probing with the CMB, you're talking about EV scale, you can really replace this kind by four fermion interaction, which is going to be plenty, very accurate for our purpose because we're putting very low energy here. And what we want is we want these neutrinos to not be free streaming, say at the Yerpakov recombination a bit before. We need this new kind of Fermi-like constant to be much larger than the normal Fermi constant. Now, in terms of cosmology, once you introduce this new physics at zeroth order, what it does is that it introduces neutrino opacity. So neutrinos now are not just free streaming. They don't have a very long mean free path. They keep bouncing off other neutrinos as they propagate in the universe. And basically, one thing you can think about this, that we've introduced a neutrino visibility function, which really tells you about when does neutrino now decouple, or when do they start free streaming. They still decouple from the electrons, you know, the standard 1.5 MeV or so, but they stay coupled to themselves until much later, and depending on what this Fermi-like constant is doing, you can delay this decoupling to, you know, the epoch, some epoch very close to recombination, for instance. So this is really the main point. We've now delayed the onset of neutrino free streaming, which is really what we wanted to do, but introducing these new interactions. So if you want to solve cosmology with these kind of neutrinos, now you have to kind of rethink what your old Boltzmann hierarchy is doing, and that's what we did in this paper, building on some of the work we've done before, and also on this kind of fantastic paper by Elizabeth Aldengott back in 2015. And you know, I'm not gonna bore you with the details, but the point is that now, because of these new interactions, you have this big collision term you have to compute. I would really describe these different neutrino interactions. And just like the weak electroweak interaction, it scales like a t to the fifth power because it's a massive mediator in our case. Now, if I go back to my free streaming neutrino picture, by introducing these new interactions now, neutrinos are no longer free streaming. So they cannot, you don't only have the stale of free streaming neutrino that gets ahead of this photon baryon plasma sound wave. So you no longer have this thing here, which means you no longer get this kind of phase shift. So the photon now really behave like this kind of blue red line here instead of this kind of green line. So you no longer get this phase shift, you no longer get this amplitude suppression. And maybe, as we will see, this helps reconciling the sound horizon with the low redshift probe and not messing up the CMB too much.
So the dashed curve doesn't look like that anymore.
Yeah, so the neutrinos no longer behave like this. It's actually the blue line, but now the blue line and the red line are exactly on top of each other because now basically neutrino behaves like photon. They're scattering fluid.
But why does the sound horizon have to point
somewhere? Oh, it's just because this is a picture taking a very early time. So eventually they'll spread out a little from the baryon photon loading. It's just that this is very early time. So, yeah. So if you now, if you think about this, was all a cartoonish pictures of fluctuation, but now if you think about the, in terms of data in measurement, and so let's see what this does at the spectrum, at the level of the spectrum, the power spectrum itself. And so I'm just going to walk you through this plot because I think it's pretty important. So this is, you know, the fractional change compared to lambda CDM. So let's see, I'm this kind of solid horizontal line here. The first line I want to draw your attention to is this dash dotted black line here, actually, which is just the same thing as lambda CDM, which is have cranked up and effective to 4. Here, the neutrinos are free streaming and all. And what you see is this kind of situation I was telling you about. Once you introduce free streaming neutrinos, you just have too much damping. You suppress a bit the photon fluctuation, and you get some kind of phase shift, which you can see from these oscillations here. Now, if I do the same, say I do this red solid, let's consider the red solid line. Now this is ineffective equals 3.046, just like lambda CDM. But now I've cranked up the interaction strength of the neutrino to very large value. So now the neutrinos are not free streaming at early times. And I get a solid line now. And I guess the interesting thing to get from this plot is that it kind of goes in the opposite direction than just changing ineffective. And that's really the whole point here. If I just change effective, I tend to suppress the spectrum. If I just introduce some interaction, I go the other way. I introduce too much power. And then this dotted red dotted line here is when I combine both together. That is, I increase ineffective, say 4, just like this line here, but I also crank up the cross-section for neutrinos, and I get this thing here. Now, this is not a fit. I'm just varying two parameters at a time here. But you can see that they affect them to cancel each other, which is really what this is trying to achieve. You're trying to increase an effective to change the sun horizon early times, to change this Hubble rate at early times, without doing too much damage to the CME. This is what this is trying to do. And this isn't a fit, so you know you could adjust some of the other parameters to get some of the other residuals here. But at face value, this looks pretty good. Something we didn't expect when we started this, and this little aside, is that once you introduce this new neutrino physics, because you change the way the gravitational potential is evolving in early times, you also change the way matter is clustering, or dark matter is clustering. Now, here there's no direct coupling between neutrinos and dark matter. They're just talking normally through gravity. But because the gravitational potentials behave differently when radiation is free streaming or not free streaming, dark matter knows about that. And that's quite interesting. Again, this is again a little BC plot. So this is the matter power spectrum as a function of weight number, putting the ratio of some interacting neutrino model to send a lambda CDM. And so just first, let's just look at this red line here. So this is the ratio, and then this kind of peak here, and there's some damping on very small scale or large wave number. This is for fairly large cross section. And this peak here is an interesting signature. And this mode that corresponds to the scale here is basically the mode that enters the causal horizon when neutrinos are decoupling from themselves, or at the onset of neutrino free streaming. So the dark matter has a memory of when this neutrino goes from tightly coupled to free streaming, and that's quite interesting. And on a smaller scale than this probe, this scale, there's actually a net damping compared to the CDM. Again, because of the gravitational potential doesn't behave as in the CDM for these models, you end up with slightly less dark matter clustering on small scales in these models. And basically, as you change the coupling constant, if you make it a bit smaller, like in this blue line, you change the scale to smaller scale because it's corresponding to modes that enters earlier, so your neutrinos start free streaming earlier. So you get this signature that moves around as you change the epoch of the coupling. Also shown on this plot is the effect of neutrino mass. So we know that actually these kind of techniques are looking at the suppression of this matter power spectrum from just the existence of neutrino mass. It's basically the way we measure neutrino mass in cosmology. And this is shown, say, for this black dotted line. This is the standard features of introducing neutrino mass in cosmology. This is for a fairly large neutrino mass, but what you get is just like a damping on small scales. And a lot of large-scale structure experiment nowadays are basically looking for this shift, this suppression on the matter power spectrum to try to measure neutrino mass. Now, what's interesting here is that as you introduce these new interaction, you kind of change the whole shape of this transition here. So if you look at this dash red line, now you do have this peak that I talked about, we also get even more suppression from the existence and region of mass. So for if this was the truth model of the universe, I'm not saying it is, but if this was, this tells you that whatever measurement of neutrino mass you'll be making will be a lot more complicated than you think, because you introduce a lot more rich structure to the amount of power spectrum here, which I think this is quite interesting. All right, and just finally on the matter power spectrum. So I haven't told you what ineffective does, which is kind of the point here. So if you might not know that, but if you increase ineffective, actually on small scale, you tend to introduce too much power in the matter power spectrum. And again, I'm a bit like the CMB, as you increase ineffective, but also increase the cross section to neutrinos, you try to compensate this effect. And then returning a matter power spectrum that's much less damped or has too much power compared to lambda CDM. Of course, now you have to deal with the fact that you have this big peak here, which might, you know, at face value might think that's a big problem, because you do have, I mean, these are prime scale where we have good measurement. And I'll come back to that again, because the answer we get when we do the fit is actually quite interesting, despite the presence of this peak. So we'll come back to that in a minute. All right, so I've told you about the physics, now this changed dark matter clustering, I'll just change the CMB. Now we're gonna look at some data and see what this tells us, and a lot of this work was done by Princeton student Christina Kreisch. So if you just, you know, use Planck data and ask the question, how does this fit? The first surprising thing you obtain is that you get this kind of bimodal posterior probability distribution, which tells you that there's kind of two cosmology here that the data seems to like. And especially if you look at this kind of row here, this is a column here, this is G effective. This is basically the coupling constant for neutrinos. And this is kind of two values that gets picked out. And this is strongly degenerate with, say, the value of the angular size of the sound horizon, the amplitude of the matter power the amplitude of CMB fluctuation, and the scalar spectral index. So there's all this kind of degeneracy structure here and bimodality you can see. And just to introduce some language here, so this mode that corresponds to fairly large value of this cross-section, we're going to call this a strongly interacting neutrino mode, or SINU. And the rest of this posterior, we're going to call this the MINU, or moderately interacting neutrino mode. So now I'm going to take these two modes of this posterior and just separate them and just show them side by side to see how does the parameter space kind of maps out as you separate them out. So now this SINU is this kind of solid red line here. And as we said, it favors a fairly large value of the cross-section. And this is 10 to the minus, you know, 1.5. And, you know, just in these units, the Fermi constant, the normal Fermi constant is about 10 to the minus 11. There will be a minus 11, right, in these units. So this is much, much stronger than the Fermi interaction. Just want to kind of orient you on that. So these are very strong interaction. And if you do the fit for this SINU mode, ineffective, this kind of density, density in radiation early times kind of peaks around 4, which if you think about neutrino physics is an interesting number to be, especially if you're thinking that you need extrasterial neutrinos to try to explain neutrino anomalies.
So this is for the big edge knot?
Sorry?
This is big edge knot?
Yes. This is, I don't have it here. Yeah, temperature, lensing, BAO, and Reese. And Reese, yeah.
How would you explain these neutrino anomalies, the extra species, very large mass, right? For some of the masses around 1.6.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that this is exact model that you want for the...
Because otherwise you need splitting of like one electron mode.
Yeah, if you want, I mean, you do have a tail, but it's not going all the way there. From cosmology. So this is an interesting number, but yeah, you have to think about that. So, you know, the whole motivation to do this whole business of interacting neutrinos was the sound horizon business, and you can actually see that the sound horizon could be quite a bit smaller here. So this is the standard sound horizon in lambda CDM, which is about 147 megaparsec, and now we get something that it's much more around 137 or something. So this is more or less what we wanted. We wanted to be able to reduce the sound horizon so that we can reconcile BAO and distance ladder measurement. And in consequence, the Hubble rate is not now a lot more compatible with distance ladder measurement, which is good. And again, you know, this is the measurement we get from this mode, and this is the measurement that in Euler et al. This is the value that they say they will need in order to reconcile the BIO, the low redshift BIO, and residual measurement. So these values are kind of more or less the same, so which is good. So we kind of achieve our goal here, that we've introduced a model that gives us a sun horizon that's compatible in reconciling these low redshift data, which is good.
But you have already included H0 data in these fits, as what you said.
Right.
It's not surprising, and then you get the same H0.
Yeah, actually you can throw a lot of model out there, and even if you include H0, it's not clear you're gonna get 72, most of the time you get 69. But actually, I'm going to show you a fit without including the residual measurement in this model. And we'll see that it actually naturally likes to go there without the data. So I guess that's a good question. That's the first question you should ask. That's exactly. So just kind of keeping going in this plot, one of the thing I get asked about the most is this measurement of the angular size of the sun horizon in the CMB. This is a bit strange because, you know, if you look at CMB data, the typical angular size of fluctuation is probably the best metric quantity in all of cosmology. But yet, if you actually use this model, you get a very different value. And the difference between, you know, this lambda CDM values and what we get here is exactly this phase shift. So, and it's not like we've changed the angle in the sky. It's that the models have actually changed to try to reabsorb this the absence of this phase shift into other parameters. And another nice feature of this model is that the amplitude of matter fluctuation comes out slightly low, which is good if you think that there's an anomaly between amplitude of matter fluctuation and redshift zero. Most models that try to solve this Hubble constant always end up having a larger value. This model gets a lower value, which is kind of a little bonus here. And the reason for that is shown actually here. So I was telling you before, as I was showing you the matter power spectrum, you always get a feature in a matter power spectrum whenever you have these transition from self-interacting neutrinos to free-streaming neutrinos, and you do get this feature here, but it's just so that in the fit, it kind of lines up so that around the scale that contribute the most to sigma 8, the typical fluctuation on the scale of 8 megaparsec, it kind of lines up with lambda CDM. And I want to emphasize, this was not built in. This was not necessarily, you know, supposed to happen, but it did happen. Now, of course, you can see this, you know, there's a whole, the whole trend, the whole spectral index is actually quite different here, which means that on fairly small scale, you can broke with small, say, like dwarf galaxies and all, you do get a suppression at the 25% level, which is interesting for small scale structure. But there's a non-trivial shape in these models. And again, if you have a galaxy surveys and you try to do, say, BO analysis of this kind of data, I think you have to be quite careful because the shape around where you're actually measuring it might be quite different than lambda CDM. So there's a whole all issues here about how do you properly analyze the data where you just, when you're back, your background is not just a part of, but you have some feature on top of it. That's interesting. We're going to leave this for future work. And this is the plot that Nayesh was just asking about. So now what happened, what I've told you so far is like I've included in my analyses the local H0 measurement from CFID, et cetera. What happens if I don't do that? If I just ask a question for just the CMB? And this is what you get, is this kind of red region here. And it's hard to see, but the residual measurement is some kind of band here. And I've also included HSC measurement of the amplitude of matter fluctuation at late time, which is this kind of band here, which we cannot see. But the point is that lambda CDM is here, so this model allows you to go towards larger value of the Hubble constant and lower value of matter fluctuation without including this data or this data. So the model really wants to go, like naturally could have accommodated these data without necessarily having the data itself push you in that direction, which is interesting. I thought it was quite interesting. So now you may say, okay, you've done through all this exercise. I didn't tell you about the quality of the fit. So I get this whole thing fit. If you look, say, that's an absolute kind of delta chi-square value. This is what this is shown here. For the different component of the data, you know, CMB IL and low L, CMB lensing, this residual measurement of H0 and the BAO. And a negative number mean here you've improved the fit compared to lambda CDM, because a lot of the improvement comes from just H0. And you don't do too badly on everything. So that overall, compared to just Lambda CDM, we do a bit better, about say minus 8. But you would say, oh yeah, but you know, we introduced all these extra parameters. Now you have the cross section for neutrinos. You have neutrino mass in there that's varying this fit. You have an effector that's varying this fit. Say I'm gonna try to compensate for that by demanding that my chi-square increase by this value of 2 for each parameter I add. Even if I do that, it's still negative, so it's not so bad. So it seems that it looks like, you know, the fit is kind of good on the absolute term, which is at least, you know, the basic test to pass. It's not amazing, it's just good. And another important question is, you know, you've gone through all this exercise of introducing all these interactions, you have to redo all your Boltzmann and hierarchy and all of that. Was it all worth it? At the end, does this new interaction actually make a difference in terms of data fitting? And it does quite a lot. So what I'm showing here is so the solid red line is actually some best fit that we get to the data. And then I want to show you what happened if I keep all the same parameters, but I just remove the interaction, just set the cross section to neutrinos to 0, and then compare the two models, just to see how much of the interaction themselves make a difference. And this is the difference here. I'm talking something, you know, at the 15, 20% level here. So the interaction actually matters a lot into driving this model towards something that fits decently. Now, it doesn't fit perfectly, as I said, it's an okay fit. But the interaction, the new physics we've introduced actually plays an important role here. All right, just wrapping up here. So what does this strongly attracting neutrino work? So ineffective increases the Hubble rate at early times and reduces the sun horizon, which was the reason why we do that. The study couple neutrinos do not overdamp the CMB and do not like overly phase shift the CMB either, which allows us to keep the goodness of fit to the CMB without while changing the sun horizon, basically. And the remaining change to the CMB and the matter parts could be absorbed by changing NS and AS. In ways that doesn't actually lead to too much matter fluctuation at late time, which is the difference to most other solutions to the Hubble rate.
So the scalar NS shifts to higher value or lower value?
Lower value. So Lambda CDM is here at 0.97.
Yeah.
And we're more at 0.94. So a bit lower. A bit less scale invariant if you want. Yeah.
So what does that say for?
If you care about like inflation.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because it moves you. It moves you towards lower NS. Now I don't remember this. Maybe someone knows this better, but
forget. That's why I'm asking.
For the R.
Yeah. How does it go with R? How does it go with M squared, Y squared, and all the models?
As far as I know, this hasn't been done, so I don't know. But I think it's something that should be considered. But I think the blob is pretty. It's not that digital.
So lower NS would magnify for an M squared faster than one lower NS. So I think it's better for those.
For polynomial.
Okay.
So there's something if you're interested in that. So I thought it's an okay fit, but I mean, we need to consider the dark side of things here. And that's what I'm gonna spend the remainder of this talk about. So the required strength from a particle physics perspective is completely insane. You're talking about the G effective, that's 10 orders of magnitude above the Fermi constant. That's huge. And of course, you have to square this to get the cross section, right? So that's a large number.
Yeah.
So these are very strong interactions. Although they decouple in the very little universe, you know, or before recombination, it's still very strong interaction. It's unclear whether CMB polarization can fully come out of these models. And I have a slide about this in a second. And as told you, the shape of the matter parts spectrum is kind of very different in this case. You have this bump, maybe the spectral index is different. So given that we already have a lot of data on this, and we're going to get even more data on the area of LSSD, it remains to be seen whether this becomes a problem. Let me go to the polarization question first. It's something I've done very recently. This is not in a paper, this is unpublished. Now we're not done, but I've shown you so far is basically this model, the black model. The only difference here is I've added some ilium measurement from the, you know, the pristine gas in the early universe. And now I'm doing the same analysis with polarization data on top of it. And basically, I think the bottom line is the answer doesn't change too much, which is good. And just to illustrate this, so this is a Hubble constant, and this green band is residual measurement, or if you want this 1D bus over here. And adding polarization, moving from black to red, it does bring you to lower value a little bit. It's not dramatic. And the main reason for this is that the polarization is better at measuring the phase shift from the free streaming. And it seems that once you add the data, you kind of constrain this phase shift better. So it's harder to kind of play with it by a little bit. Still not that bad. Remember, the lambda CDM is all the way down here. Particle model constraints. So there's different things you can try to do. Kind of sticking around my Yukawa model, and this is work by Nikita Blinov and collaborators at Fermilab from this basically last month. And they kind of took this kind of idea of SINU and tried to see, if I think about what kind of particle constraint I have on these kind of scenarios, what can I do? So the first thing you can do, and this is the thing we did, is what about universal coupling that couples to everything equally? All the different flavors equally. And that's just like, you can imagine it's just widely ruled out. And there's different lines here, but I mean, this is just BBN, because the mediator is there, it's relativistic at time of BBN.
So by universal coupling, what do you mean? Can you write down the Lagrangian for these things?
Oh, I can go back. I mean, it was within this very simple model.
I don't remember the kind of with the electrons.
Is this basically this?
No, that's not right. That's not right. Write down an SU2 invariant thing.
Oh no, I'm not gonna do that today.
Eh?
I do have a slide on this for the seesaw realization of this model. But just saying in the low energy theory you could just
I don't care about this. Can you please show
We don't really care.
Yes.
About the low energy theory. We want to see what the theory looks like above 100 GeV.
Yes.
Above 100 GeV?
Yes. So show an SU2 invariant.
Anyone knows.
I'm not sure there is anything to know.
Yeah.
I don't think there is such a theory.
I mean, I can tell you two models that actually might work. The problem with both models is whether you can get the interaction that's strong enough. Because you want them to be 10 orders of magnitude.
But that's precisely the point.
That's
so
the point. 10 orders of magnitude means you have a new particle, for example, of one.
All right, let me go back up. All right, let's consider this.
Okay.
That's a potential way to do this. That's just a simple type 1 seesaw, right?
Okay.
So how light is?
So there is a right-handed neutrino.
Yeah,
this couples to phi.
Yeah, this is a standard kind of seesaw. There's right-handed neutrinos, a lepton doublet, and you have these kind of the mass term here. Neutrino mass is kind of a standard seesaw story, but then you can integrate out the mediator just like we did for the Yukawa model. And that's what I was telling you earlier, that if you just do have a simple seesaw and try to just do this kind of Yukawa like this, is that this G factor that you get is always suppressed by the neutrino mass itself. So it's just difficult to get this, because you need this constant to be very large.
Exactly.
So you can try to make this mediator as large as possible, which you can, but you can't really go much below a kV. It just becomes difficult.
Exactly.
So the way you would like to do that, you need to introduce two copies of these, like a two seesaw. One seesaw control the neutrino mass, the other seesaw will control the strength of these interaction. I think this is going to be beyond my capabilities right now. I'm really a cosmologist here, should appreciate that. So this is one example you can do that. It's difficult in a seesaw. The other example you can try to do.
So by two seesaw, what do you mean? So here there is MN that gives the mass of the neutrino.
Yeah, I think you need another copy of these. You need more right-handed neutrinos.
And then what happens?
So one couple is a mass, another couple is.
Yes, exactly.
Can you go to the board and write?
Yeah, can you go to the board and
write? I could try to do that, but that's beyond the point what I'm trying to say here. So this is not changing. You want to introduce another copy of these?
Okay.
Right, but now you have, if you introduce another copy of these, you have an extra, you introduce another parameter you can control.
But then how do you get...
You have two extra parameters you can control, right? You have this coupling constant, which you can try to dial. And of course, you always have this mass parameters to dial here.
Yeah.
And you have now this mass scale also of the right end that you can play with. So the problem in this simple seesaw is that this, you know, this is small. This ratio is small, like instruction.
Yeah.
And that makes these interaction just very weak by construction. But if you had another copy of those, then you have basically two extra parameters to try to make this ratio quite a bit larger.
But how do you make it larger? Is there like some
it's
there's
some like maybe ratio
of,
like
the
lambda.
Like I have a different question. Yeah. Like how does supernova happen like in your model?
The constraint from supernova here is technically is you don't if I go back to my So if you go to that parameter space, and the constraint from the supernova comes from asking that you don't want the mediator to outshine the neutrinos.
No, like the neutrinos are interacting very strongly. They don't come.
Yeah, but they will. But yeah. They would annihilate into the mediator, and at zero to order, you don't want the since you've measured luminosity from supernova from the neutrino sphere. You don't want that luminosity from the mediator to outshine the neutrinos, because the one that you saw from the neutrino was pretty compatible.
It's just one thing, right? Your high-energy neutrinos, they are interacting with the...
Yeah,
like
that argument actually that they would not escape the neutrino sphere, that's not true, actually. So there was a paper actually after 1980s of NA saying, if you have this strong interaction, the neutrinos won't get out of supernova. But that's not true, because if you really have a radial explosion, it's not because neutrinos are going to scatter some other neutrino in some direction that neutrinos won't escape. For every neutrino that scatters slightly off the line of sight, off the radial direction, another is going to be a scatter in the radial direction. So in the whole escape of neutrinos from supernova is probably in change. But you do have to worry about that you're going to be emitting a lot of these mediators.
I think like when you have like a really strong interaction with thermolines, right?
Sure, but they still get out. You want them to get out on time.
Yeah, so they were like a basically random walk, right?
It takes much longer. That's exactly what I'm saying, right? I mean, if you move in a radial direction, you can see either off and off this direction, but on average, you're still going to be moving outward.
So you'll see like the same curve, like off the.
But in neutrino, just I mean, no one has done that calculation because try to convince the supernova specialists, they barely understand normal neutrinos. Try to tell them to say, you know, what if I change my properties, although I change my supernova, it's difficult. So analytically, the only thing you can do, you can think about this kind of random walk process. You can talk about luminosity in terms of the mediator. That's the two things I can do, and both of these things are fine. So that's all I know.
I mean, if your average walk out of the explosion is longer than 10 seconds, whatever the spread was,
yeah. Yeah, but it's not that long. As far as I know. So it's going to pass the time. If you move away from this universal kind of coupling, and you say I'm going to do some kind of flavor dependence in my kind of Yukawa matrix here, the only thing we can do is just couple to tau, because the tau leptons is not that well constrained. And the only thing we have to deal with is this is the tau lepton decays into the phi and changing the three-body kinematics. And actually working with these guys right now to try to put more meat into this model here. So let's just wrap up since I'm talking about the hours. So I think as you increase the precision of data in cosmology, it's normal that you start to see cracks in the cosmological model, that things start not agreeing with each other. And inspired by the status of neutrino physics, kind of just took it and run with it. You can introduce self-neutrino self-interaction, and it does something good for cosmological data. It really helps. That's something good. But as we said, this model that we have is completely insane. So how do we get something that's good and then build something? It's still a challenge for the particle physics side to make this work. But it doesn't mean it's impossible. So I think the main message here is that it's possible to find something that's completely different than what you know, that's very different than the CDM, and still fit the data pretty well. I mean, that's kind of unexpected. I mean, we kind of think of the CDM when we change the CDM, we add some bells and whistles here. But this is a model that's just separate, just completely different in terms of its parameter space, and it still fits the data reasonably well. So this begs the question of what else is out there, what else you can do with model building in order to improve, kind of reconcile some of these fits. Thank you.
all your tests that assume there are any.
So in the fit actually presented to is it's basically you have one mass instance. It's basically the case with all the most of the masses is some sterile species that's scattering with all the active.
Okay.
We also run the case where you have some just a degenerate spectrum on the tree now. So all I mean you have three species, but more and more has the same mass, and the answer doesn't change it that much.
And also, if you add additional sterile species, you have to consider the oscillation between the active and the sterile species. And
right. I mean, right. So, in fact, these kind of ideas were introduced to try to have the sterile not terminalize with the active at early times through the kind of quantum Zeno effect. So if the sterile, if the active keeps scattering very quickly, you don't have time to oscillate the sterile, so you don't terminalize the sterile at early times, so you kind of try to evade BBM. So this is the kind of model that could actually do that for you.
You didn't do very detailed analysis to say what is the number density and what is the energy density of the sterile species. Like, we assume there is oscillation and there is some kind of automatic potential. What would be the result regarding this kind of new
index? Oh, to the, I mean, once you have to compute this potential from scratch. I mean, this is something, right? That's fairly new. But the potential is being computed for these models in the early universe when you're trying to not terminalize the sterile. But after some times, you know, after BBN, in all these models, you actually terminalize the sterile, and that's why, in effect, I mean, that's one reason why effective can become large here. Now, as far as the CMB is concerned, which is mostly probing Z of 10 to the 5 or less, I think these kind of details don't matter too much because the CMB is only probing the structure of physics through gravity. They're really sensitive to whether neutrinos are free streaming or not. Basically, that's all that the photons are sensitive to.
Also, if we really had an additional zero species, and then we work in the mass eigenstate, if we write down the Maxwell-Boltzmann equations, and I guess we will introduce additional interaction, self-interaction for the both eigenstate because of the strong interaction between the active neutrinos, and that will add to the additional
opacity.
But there is an additional species that may be free streaming, but the free streaming scale is suppressed by the neutrinos.
Right. I mean, you can make your decoupling function more complicated in the sense that some maybe a species was sort of free streaming before the other, and that would if this happens after redshift 10 to the 5, then that does seem to be sensitive to that. Right now, what we've seen is that anything you try to do between 10 to the 5 and redshift of recombination, you just really, the CMB doesn't like. Like if you just try to change this fraction, because we played with this already, but what if you only have 10% or 30% of neutrinos interacting? It doesn't really work really well. It's either this strongly attracting cosmology, or not attracting at all, which is surprising.
Has anyone put around model building this phi as a chameleonic force, so that its interactions are density dependent? Because that's what Ann Nelson did with similar models to fit the anomalies back in 2008.
Okay, maybe that's an interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, so introducing extra neutrinos is one way, and as you mentioned earlier, you do want the mass differences to not to mess up other things. The other way is not to introduce extra neutrinos, but changing the terminal history, which is what Nina and others were asking about. I think you do have to worry about the solar neutrinos,
yeah, so I think that if
the mass differences.
But as soon as you have something that is OK with the cosmological bounds, because these 1 eV ones would mess up cosmology, if you have those ones that are consistent with the cosmological bounds, I think this is a problem for the solar neutrinos.
Well, that's the thing. So, I mean, when we started this, we were thinking, oh, the neutrino mass, the cosmological bound will be the same as in standard and SCDM. But the thing is, once you introduce this new physics, the neutrino mass bound actually change. So it's, you know, in another CDM it's like 0.1 EV, now maybe it's 0.6 EV because the physics is different. But I think what you're saying is you do have to be careful to introduce, if you want to go the direction of choosing another species, you want to make sure you don't mess up anything else. So that's why I think overall the not introducing a new species, but just having some extra physics instead that kind of reheat the neutrinos to an effective of 4 or something is probably a more potential route that doesn't mess up normal neutrino experiments.
Another question, but